I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Poverty, the widening wealth gap, inequality, and calls to increase the minimum wage is getting widespread attention. Republicans are talking about it, and this year's World Economic Summit in Davos, Switzerland, placed rising inequality at the top of its agenda. President Obama is expected to address the rise in inequality and wages at tonight's State of the Union speech. A new report by Oxfam shows that 85 of the wealthiest people in the world have as much wealth as half of the world's population. And according to a 2011 census, 15% of U.S. residents, or 46 million people, live in poverty. That's the official poverty line. And of those, roughly 10.5 million are categorized as the working poor. So on today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by focusing on the tens of millions of people employed in low-wage industries. The number of people who are not able to make ends meet has skyrocketed in the United States. Roughly a quarter of all Americans work for less than $10 an hour. So what will it take to create opportunities for people who make low wages and do not receive benefits? Today we're joined by Saru Jayaraman. She's co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Centers United, an organization that works to improve wages and working conditions for the nation's 10 million restaurant workers. Saru is also director of the Food Labor Research Center at the UC Berkeley Labor Center and author of Behind the Kitchen Door, and she joins us from Los Angeles. Hi, Saru. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Sasha Abramsky. He's a longtime writer on the subject of poverty. His latest book, The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Live, is the result of hundreds of interviews with organizations that serve and the people that live in poverty. And many of his interviews for this project are archived at voicesofpoverty.org. And Sasha joins us from Davis. Hi, Sasha. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Mia Birdsong is vice president of the Family Independence Initiative, an organization that envisions a future in which each person and family recognizes their self-determination and has access to the resources and community they need to thrive. Hi, Mia. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thanks.
Good morning. So let's start off by talking about what's in the news right now. President Obama is giving his State of the Union speech tonight, and he's going to talk about inequality and the economy and jobs and wages. Saru, what are you hoping to hear from the president? And on this issue, what power does he have to really change things?
Yeah, so we're very hopeful that he is going to talk about a bill that's moving through Congress called the Fair Minimum Wage Act of 2013, now 2014. It will go a long way towards, a first step towards raising the wage. It proposes raising the wage not just for everybody to $10.10, but for tipped workers in particular, it proposes raising the wage to 70% of the regular or starting at $7 an hour. Now, most people may not know that outside of California, the wages for tipped workers in 43 states in the country actually range from $2.13 an hour, which is the federal minimum wage, to anywhere to $4 or $5 an hour. And so in most states in the country, workers who earn tips, which are millions and millions of workers in the United States, live completely off their tips because their wages are so low they go entirely to taxes. So we're definitely hoping that the president mentions the Fair Minimum Wage Act and pushes for an increase in the overall minimum wage to $10.10, which he's likely to do. But we're especially hopeful that he mentions tipped workers in particular because these workers have not seen an increase in over 22 years.
Wow.
And so this would be a historic moment to really see a rise for these workers in particular.
And we will definitely talk about the 10 million people who work in restaurants, because you say the food system now isn't a bad employer, it's actually the worst employer in the United States. So we'll talk about that in just a few minutes. Sasha, you spent a couple of years on the road interviewing people who work and cannot make ends meet. What would you like to hear from the president, and what do you think he has the power to actually do on this issue?
Well, I think the president has tremendous power because basically he sets a national tone. And when he uses the State of the Union effectively, he really can dictate the direction that a conversation goes in. One of the things I'd like him to focus on is that as inequality has gotten worse, and as inequality in America in particular has gotten worse at a rate that it hasn't in other first world democracies, one of the implications is that tens of millions of people who have jobs still aren't able to pay their bills. And one of the things that struck me when I was going around the country was the number of people who said something to the effect of the month is longer than the paycheck. And I'd ask them what they meant by that. And what they meant was that for maybe a week or two, or maybe even three out of the month, they were okay. They could put food on their table. If they got sick, they could buy medicines. But in week four, they went hungry, and they ended up on food bank lines, or they ended up going to charities, or they ended up borrowing from friends or borrowing from payday lenders. And I think that it is that insecurity, that gnawing, nagging insecurity, that so many people working for some of the wealthiest companies in the world are now experiencing as their daily realities, their daily norms. That's what I really hope he focuses on. And I hope he really explores the fact that as a society, for too long, we've ignored this crisis. We pretended that it doesn't exist. Now everybody knows it does exist. And so the conversation shifts. Now I hope the conversation becomes, well, what do we do about it? How do we marshal the kind of energies that Lyndon Johnson managed to marshal in 1964 when he made poverty a national priority? Can we do that again in 2014?
Well, you brought up food banks. Do you think society really understands what we're facing? Because according to a report released last week by the Food Bank for New York City, because of the cuts to food stamps, 48% of emergency food providers actually ran out of food. So they spoke to hundreds of food pantries and soup kitchens in New York, and they found that because food stamps are being cut, the food banks can't keep up with demand, and they're actually running out of food.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a huge problem. I actually opened my book with a scene in a very small food pantry in Appalachian, Pennsylvania, and the woman who was taking me through the pantry, her name was Jenny Wallace, and she went into their pantry storage area, and she opened these freezer and fridges, and one after another, they were literally empty. There was nothing in them. Mm. And she said to me, well, a couple years before, these were all full. And then demand went up and up and up and up, partly because there was this crunch on food stamps, but more generally because so many people were now experiencing poverty. And by 2011, that food pantry was basically on a weekly basis running out of food, and it was having to ration what it was giving out. And I think that the scale of this is something that we just haven't witnessed in this country for generations. The fact that so many American families, many of whom have people employed, are still unable to make ends meet. And it's not a temporary thing anymore, it's chronic. This is just a part of their daily existence. And so I really do think it's absolutely essential that Obama focuses national attention on this.
Mia, what's been interesting is to watch also the Republicans talk about poverty and inequality and really slam the president for his economic policies. And I mean, it's an interesting corner they're pushing Democrats in because they cannot ignore this issue any longer. But do you think that what the president says tonight will have any teeth? And the same question to you, what power does he actually have on this issue?
You know, we take a slightly different perspective, and I think in addition to the things that Saru and Sasha mentioned, you know, the power of the bully pulpit that he has, I think, is tremendous. And what I'd really love for him to kind of remind us is who built this country. And remind all of us that, like, working poor people have and continue to be the driving force of our economy. And if we stop looking at, you know, what can we do to help people and what can we actually do, how can they help us? What can we do to invest in what people are already doing to get ahead so that we can actually create prosperity from the bottom up? That's what I'd really love him to do, which is really about shifting the perspective we have on low-income people as either being, you know, helpless victims or lazy moochers. And just remember that, like, you know, for centuries, like, low-income folks, hardworking people built our country and made it what it is, and we need to recognize
that. And how does that translate to policy changes?
So I will totally admit I'm not a policy person. It's really about changing the way that we think about policy, I think, and the thinking that we bring to the table when we create policy. And you know, we built the war on poverty 50 years ago by focusing on what it was that people need. So, you know, if it was that they were hungry or they were houseless or, you know, that school systems were bad or whatever. And what our perspective is that, you know, people are taking a tremendous amount of initiative and working really hard to move their lives forward and have developed solutions for themselves. So all those folks who are having a hard time making ends meet from their wage to job, you know, many of them start side businesses so they can figure things out. There's this entrepreneurial spirit that exists. Or they trade childcare with each other because childcare is too expensive. So there are all of these solutions will develop. And if we were to actually ask those questions instead of asking, you know, what are your deficits and where is your life not working? And instead we said, well, what is it that you're doing yourself ahead and what kinds of things would help you leverage what you're already doing, I think that it would inform policy in a very different way. Hmm.
Well, and Saru, why don't you talk a little bit about just the massive protests that we've seen over the last year from Walmart to McDonald's. A lot of restaurant workers took to the streets to talk about, you know, higher wages and better working conditions. I mean, for these workers in particular, when you're talking about expanding economic opportunities, what does that mean beyond raising the minimum wage?
It means really getting to a livable wage. You know, here's the thing, is that if the minimum wage had risen, as you know, with inflation, we would be closer to really around $18 an hour at this point. You know, we're talking about wages that are $7 for most workers and $2 for tipped workers. We're talking about nowhere, not even half of what, you know, even the wage had it kept pace with inflation would be. And I think part of what's missing here is a real naming of who's responsible for this, right? The restaurant industry right now is the second largest and fastest growing sector of the U.S. economy. It's also the absolute lowest paying employer. An industry lobby would have you believe that's because restaurants suffer from uniquely thin profit margins, when in fact the restaurant industry nationally enjoys 4 to 5 times the profit margin of Walmart. So how is it that you've got the largest and fastest growing industries in America proliferating the absolute lowest paying jobs? It is because of political power of groups like the National Restaurant Association, which we call the other NRA, and which really has been at the forefront of keeping the wage as low as it is for both tipped and non-tipped workers, and is the reason that the restaurant industry is not only the largest employer of minimum wage workers in the United States, but also the only industry that's managed to convince Congress and the American people that they should be the only industry that shouldn't have to pay their own workers' wages. Customers should pay their workers' wages. So I think what we're seeing in terms of workers rising up in Walmart and in restaurant companies across the country is a real recognition that enough is enough. We need livable wages. We need to be able to actually earn enough to put food on our families' tables. These are professions. These are not just, you know, throwaway jobs for teenagers. Most of the workers in these jobs are adults with children. They consider themselves to be professionals. They stay in these industries for their lifetime because they take great pride in hospitality and food service. And really, we need to name those who are responsible for treating them as if they're not professionals, treating them as if they're throwaway, disposable workers, treating them as if they're not human, frankly, treating them as if they don't deserve the ability to support themselves without living on food stamps.
And yet, Sasha, the reality is the majority of the jobs that are being created now tend to be low wage and part-time, which means no benefits are being offered.
Yeah, people often say, well, what's happened is the good-paying manufacturing jobs have disappeared and what's replaced them are bad-paying service sector work, and that's just the way it is. But I actually think that that's a completely wrong way of looking at it. The reason that manufacturing jobs paid well was because over many, many decades at the start of the 20th century, there were unions fought to represent workers and then fought to get those workers decent pay and decent benefits. There's nothing in the abstract concept of the economy which would suggest that a steel worker or a car worker, an auto worker, has to get paid $15 to $20 an hour and up, and somebody working in a restaurant, a fast food restaurant in particular, has to get paid $7 or $8. There's absolutely nothing in the law of economics to say that. Over many, many decades, working Americans pushed for better representation in manufacturing. And it seems to me that if we are moving towards a service economy, and there's no doubt that in the last few decades our economy has dramatically restructured, if the new reality is that more and more Americans are going to be spending lifetimes working in service industries, are going to be spending lifetimes working in places like Walmart or McDonald's or Kentucky Fried Chicken and so on, in that case, the effort has to be to organize those workers into unions in much the same way as 70, 80, 100 years ago, their great-grandparents were organized into unions in the steel foundries, in the coal mines, in the car factories, and so on. And that seems to me where the effort is. And so over the last few months, this campaign for a living wage in the fast food industry, it's been extraordinarily interesting to me, at least in part because for the first time in a generation, unions are making a really big effort to organize this traditionally unorganized sector of the economy. And the same in Walmart, that you've seen wildcat strikes in several Walmarts. And Walmart has spent a huge amount of effort over the years preventing unionization. And they try and say, well, we're a family, we don't need unions. Well, the Walmart version of family is to underpay its workers. And the reason Walmart's so afraid of unions is because they know that if workers organize, they will have to end up paying something closer to a living wage. And I think that's probably where the momentum's going to be in the next few years on this one.
That is Sasha Abramski. He's a longtime writer on the subject of poverty. His latest book is The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Live. We're joined also by Mia Birdsong, Vice President of the Family Independence Initiative, and Saru Jayaraman, co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunities Centers United and director of the Food Labor Research Center at the UC Berkeley Labor Center and author of Behind the Kitchen Door. And today on Your Call, we're continuing our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about the tens of millions of people employed in low-wage industries. What will it take to create jobs that actually pay a living wage for people who work in these industries, like the ones that Sasha just mentioned? About a quarter of all Americans work for less than $10 an hour, and President Obama is expected to talk about these issues at tonight's State of the Union speech. What would you like to hear? What changes would you like to see? And if you work in this sector, we actually just got an email from Denise who said, there's a flaw in our thinking that only blue-collar jobs should pay decent wages. All workers, no matter the characterization of their job title, should be paid decent wages. So what are your thoughts on this? What changes would you like to see? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And right now, there's so much attention on inequality, poverty, the wealth gap. Do you think that we'll see major changes in policies? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Saru, when you are organizing restaurant workers, what do they think about unions? Does the topic of unions come up? Because when you talk to Walmart workers, they tend to not use that word, union.
Yeah, I don't think it's about a word, right? It really is about a concept, the idea that workers can come together and demand better wages and working conditions, that there's power in unity, and that, you know, they deserve, because they are professionals, they deserve wages and working conditions that allow them to support their families, to live in decency, to not have to choose between their job and their health. I mean, one very closely related issue to the minimum wage in our industry is the lack of paid sick days and the fact that outside of San Francisco, 90% of restaurant workers in America don't have paid sick days, and two-thirds report cooking, preparing, and serving our food, with illnesses ranging from hepatitis to H1N1 to typhoid fever. All of these are true stories in my book. You know, and the thing is that in those instances, the workers are being forced to choose between their job and their health, or between their child's health and their job. And nobody should be in that circumstance. So I think it's a combination of issues that we're seeing that are really bubbling up to the top, and that in combination are making these industries just unlivable for tens of millions of workers, and unlivable, frankly, for us as customers. Do we as customers want people who are too poor to take care of themselves or too poor to take a day off when they're sick serving our food?
What do you think really sticks with the public? I mean, like McDonald's, for example. The CEO of McDonald's is making $8.7 million a year. The average worker is about $8.25 an hour. Does that stick when you talk about wages, or does sick leave stick? I mean, what really, when you're talking about public reaction to this issue, what really resonates with the public?
You know, I think right now we have a unique opportunity to really, as I said, point to who's ultimately responsible, because one of the things that really resonates with people when I'm speaking around the country is this idea that because of the political power of the National Restaurant Association, which is this silent, deadly force that is just as powerful as the other NRA, the Rifle Association, and people just don't know it. You know, the fact that they've managed to convince America and, you know, pay Congress members essentially and pay legislators to say, we shouldn't have to pay our own workers' wages. You, customers, you should pay our workers' wages for us. In fact, we shouldn't have to pay our workers' wages at all. When you're paying a wage of $2 an hour, that's $80 a week, you're not actually paying your employee a wage at all. How is it that you've got industries who managed to get away with this? And, you know, the restaurant industry, not just fast food, frankly, Olive Garden, Red Lobster, Applebee's, even Walmart, how do they get away with telling their workers, you know, go apply for public assistance, that will subsidize your wage? How is it that they get away with this? It's from pure political power, and I think we're in a moment where not only are we talking about inequality, not only are we talking about the impact on low-income people, but we're also talking about the other half of the spectrum, which is the incredibly wealthy CEOs and shareholders who are preventing these workers from getting a livable wage while raking in millions, if not billions, of dollars in profit, while actually continuing to get incredible amounts of exemptions and not even having to pay workers' wages at all.
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line, so let's take a few before we go to break. Let's hear from Tom in Point Richmond. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for calling taking my call, Rose. I've got a great show. Listen, I can relate to this subject because I am trapped in this category. I'm an older guy on a fixed income, and every month is the same old battle. It's been that way for a number of years. By the third or fourth week, you're out begging for money or help, and you're going to food lines, and you're seeing lots of other people in the same situation. It's very discouraging. Just look around and see that decent people have to put up with this in today's America. It's a throwback to the 1930s, and it's totally a shame because the administration has done nothing, not this administration, but the one before this, and Obama and Biden have done the same thing. They've ignored this thing. They fail to take action. They talk out both sides of their mouth, and they're all talking no action. I did vote for Obama twice, but I'm beginning to think, having second thoughts about him. I know he has a low approval rating, and I wish he would wake up, everybody would wake up, and deal with this problem. It's really serious.
Well, thank you so much, Tom, for calling in and sharing your story. We'll get a response in just a minute. Let's first go to Cynthia in San Francisco. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, Rose. Just a couple of questions. If we raise the minimum wage, won't we be chasing or forcing companies to automate or send their jobs offshore? And could we possibly be focusing on policies that privilege companies that provide stable, family-supporting jobs?
Well, thank you for that. I've actually been wanting to have a debate about automation because we did one a couple months back, and we actually heard from a Silicon Valley venture capitalist who said automation is going to get so bad that we're going to need a set income for people because it's going to get bad, but others disagree. So I think that would be a great debate. Sasha, just briefly, what do you think about that? Will higher wages lead to more automation?
Well, I think automation has been going on in the economy for a century, basically, and certainly after World War II, it took off massively, and the robotization of a lot of manufacturing processes really became sort of the new norm. That's not going to change, and that's not going to change whether we have a high minimum wage or a low minimum wage. Technology is shifting, and more jobs that used to be done by humans are being done by machines and by being computerized. But the question then becomes, what kind of an economy do we want? And I'm struck. I've listened to Lyndon Johnson's State of the Union address several times in the last few weeks, his famous 1964 address. And one of the things that he talked about was this idea that we wanted an economy that was our servant rather than us being the servant of the economy. We wanted economic growth, and we wanted wealth that was our servant rather than the other way around. And I think that's a really important realization, that it doesn't matter if an economy is growing and growing and growing if all of the benefits flow up to the top. That's not a good thing. What matters is getting an economy that's growing that benefits everybody. And so we need to find a way, we need to find a pathway in a world of automation, in a world of technological advances that preserves income levels for people at all levels of the economy. We need to find a way to create an economy that is in some ways fair, in a way that the current economy profoundly isn't fair. But coming back to this idea that...
Actually, we're going to take a quick break. I'll come back to you right after the break. Thank you again for calling in, Cynthia. Today on Your Call, we are talking about what it will take to create opportunities for people who make low wages. This is Your Call. It's our agenda for a new economy, and we'll be back after this.
Now, if you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, it won't be long. You get shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay, take your kids to the seashore. It ain't quite this simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. Because if you wait for the boss to raise your pay, we'll all be awaiting till Judgment Day. We'll all be buried, gone to heaven. St. Peter will be the straw boss then. Now you know you're underpaid, but the boss says you ain't. He speeds up the work till you're about to faint. You may be down and out, but you ain't beaten. You can pass out a leaflet and call a meeting. Talk it over, speak your mind, decide to do something about it.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Holly Kernan will have a conversation about the fight for net neutrality. A federal appeals court recently overturned the Open Internet Order, which is a set of rules that prohibits internet providers from giving preferences to specific content online. Critics say overturning those rules could spell the end of open access for all. So whose responsibility is it to keep the internet open? That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about what it will take to create real opportunities for people who make low wages. Roughly a quarter of all Americans work for less than $10 an hour. So many people are not able to make ends meet. And we're talking about this with Mia Birdsong, Vice President of the Family Independence Initiative. They envision a future in which each person and family recognizes their self-determination. Sasha Abramsky is author of The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Live. And Saru Jayaraman is co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Centers United and author of Behind the Kitchen Door. And Saru, I know we have to let you go soon, so I wanted to get final thoughts from you. And, you know, I also just wanted to ask you quickly, there's so much focus on changing the law for minimum wage, but what about just the company itself? I mean, are the restaurant workers making an impact? And I mean, if you look at Costco, for example, they're always the example because their workers earn about $20-$21 an hour compared to Walmart, 8 to 13. And then the Costco CEO brings in about almost $5 million a year compared with Walmart's $20 million. So, I mean, they made a decision to pay their workers more and to provide health care. So that's also part of this, right?
It is, but I don't want, you know, I will say it is very possible to make enormous profit while treating and paying your workers well. We know it to be true because we've got about 100 employer partners around the country. They range from celebrity chefs to small mom-and-pop restaurants around the country that actually provide livable wages and working conditions and are growing, thriving restaurant companies making hefty profits for themselves while providing great livable wages and benefits for their workers. So to the caller who said, shouldn't we just provide incentives for more of those employers to do so? Well, even those employer partners of ours say actually they support raising the wage through policy, you know, having federal mandates that raise the wage to a livable standard because they're out there sticking their necks out. It's, you know, it's unfair competition to them. They'd love to see a fair, more level playing field. And I think what they've been able to prove is that actually, it would be better for the business. They've been able to see that it reduces turnover for themselves. We just did a study with them and Cornell University where we surveyed about 1,100 employers, restaurant owners across the country. And we found, you know, or Cornell found, actually, that, you know, paying the highest wages and better benefits in this industry reduces your turnover in half. Now, this is an industry that experiences severe turnover. Each employee turnover costs about $4,000 per small business, right? And so, you know, and you're looking at about $12,000 or $15,000 a year in employee turnover for most small businesses. This could significantly reduce their costs and allow them to invest in their workers, drive bottom-line profitability. So we've been able to see that it is actually possible to make profit while paying your workers well and keeping low turnover costs.
Right. And well, that's why Costco is always kind of raised up as the shining example because their workers make a bit more than $20 an hour. So thank you so much for joining us, Saru.
Thank you.
Thank you. That is Saru Jayaraman, co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Centers United, author of Behind the Kitchen Door. And you can find out more about her work at yourcallradio.org. And Sasha, I'm sorry, you wanted to finish your thought.
Well, I was actually going to agree with what Daru was saying, which is that in actual fact, when you increase wages, oftentimes you reduce all of these other costs. But the second thing is, when you increase wages, it actually turns out that it doesn't impact cost to consumers that much. And the reason for that is most businesses aren't spending all of their revenue or anywhere near close to all of their revenue on wages. They're spending it on rent, they're spending it on machinery, they're spending it on inventory, they're spending it on all kinds of things in addition to wages. And even amidst the wages, they're not paying all of their workers minimum wage. So when you increase the minimum wage by a dollar or two or even three an hour, in the cities around the country that have done it, they haven't seen massive increases being passed on to consumers, and nor have they seen companies shedding vast numbers of jobs, which is what conservatives routinely say. They say, well, if you raise the minimum wage, you're going to have an unemployment crisis. Well, minimum wage has been increased in many, many cities. It's been increased in San Francisco, in Santa Cruz, in Santa Fe in New Mexico. Many cities around the country have decided that they want a higher minimum wage, and there haven't been unemployment crises in those cities resulting from it. So I do think that it's disingenuous when a very large profitable company says, well, we can't increase our lowest paid workers' salaries by a dollar or two an hour because it will scare away our consumers. There's no proof that that's the case. And I think we should be having a moral conversation here about what is the moral right way for companies to treat their employees. And clearly paying them a wage which puts them onto food lines, that's morally incorrect.
And Mia, your group, the Family Independence Initiative, really works on empowering individuals and empowering families. And I mean, we've seen a lot of people put their jobs on the line, frankly, when they protest because they're not supported by a union. They're not really protected. So beyond all of these policy changes, what really allows people and their families to exercise their power in this economy?
Well, there are three things. I mean, we're talking about basically economic and social mobility here, and increasing the minimum wage would obviously contribute tremendously to that for a lot of folks. I think there's another piece that's around kind of where we put capital investment. We have a whole set of benefits that exist for upper and, you know, middle-income folks. If there is, you know, the small middle class and the even smaller upper class. That allows people to maintain and grow their wealth. So, for example, you know, I have a 401k plan. So I put money in my retirement fund and my employer matches it. That's free money that I get. And that's for me to, you know, when I again, it's going to grow or help me maintain my wealth. When I bought my house, I got to write off. The state of California gave me like $10,000 back, and I get to write off my mortgage interest. We don't have things like that for low-income people. What we have is a set of benefits that, like food stamps or, you know, child care, that end as soon as you start to move yourself forward. We don't have a set of investments for low-income folks. And that's one of the things that we think we need to have as a just like a system that actually invests in the initiative that people are taking. So, for example, we, based on data and feedback we got from families we partner with, we came up with a new set of underwriting criteria for loans. You know, it's very hard for low-income folks to get loans because they don't have collateral. They can go to payday lenders, but those are obviously a terrible option. And people know that. They just don't have another option. So we came up with underwriting criteria that really broadens the factors considered for a loan, and also the predictability and reliability of people to pay back. And it incorporates things that are not just about your FICO score, but it also takes into account things like, you know, your rent payment history or your utilities or your cell phone payment history. It also incorporates character. So if I was very wealthy and I wanted to buy, you know, an airport and knew the bank president, I could go and talk to that person. And that would help me get, you know, the investment that I needed for my venture. Low-income people don't have those kinds of social connections, but they do have social capital in their communities. So our underwriting criteria allows people to leverage that. And that's just an example of kind of how we can think differently about investing in the initiative that low-income people are making to move their lives forward so that it actually is including them as opposed to thinking about it as charity.
And how would you go about actually implementing those ideas?
So, I mean, a lot of it is really about, again, it's about collecting different set of information. Right now, if the information that we collect on low-income people is based on their needs, it's about, like, you know, it's questions that are directed at finding out, like, do you need these different supports, as opposed to what are the things that you're doing in your life to move yourself forward? And what we do in partnership with the families that we work with is we collect information on people's initiatives. So we see the ways in which people are improving their education or their health or helping other people. And from that information, from the data we collect and from the stories we get, we then develop different sets of resources, whether it's this character-based underwriting criteria for a loan. We have, in partnership with Mission Asset Funds, we have a credit-building lending circle. We have a social networking website where people can share ways in which they've helped, you know, move themselves forward. People, you know, whether it's like I started a business and here's how I did it, and they're able to share that information. I mean, on an institutional level, it's really about taking that data collection perspective, right? I mean, Amazon and others collect a tremendous amount of data on what we do. We can apply those kind of same big data principles to the social sector and collect different information on what low-income people are doing so that we can be developing resources that actually leverage what folks are doing as opposed to looking at the needs they have and trying to just shore up the bottom.
And Sasha, during your travels and talking to people living in poverty and working for low wages, when you talk about exercising their power, what kind of response did you get? What did you hear from them?
Well, I think that one of the circumstances of poverty in America is a sense of invisibility. Mm. So a lot of the people I talked to said that as they fell further and further into poverty, they fell further and further outside what they regarded as the social mainstream. So I spoke to people who had had jobs until 2008, and then they lost their jobs. And for them, one of the things that hurt them the most wasn't the material conditions of poverty, but it was the psychology. They can no longer afford to socialize. They can no longer afford to go out and meet friends. Even for a simple thing like a cup of coffee at a Starbucks, that became a big deal because they were counting their pennies. And so, you know, in terms of them having power, it was the exact opposite. They felt very disempowered. They felt very marginalized. They felt very invisibilized. Now, that said, many, many, many people that I talked to were doing everything they could to either preserve what power they had or to find new footholds. They were going to college. They were doing job training. They were doing anything they could to find new entry points into the economy. And they were also, in some cases, doing very creative things. I went to Detroit, and I spoke to people who were living in desperate poverty. Detroit has some of the worst urban poverty in the country. And I spoke to people who had started urban gardening. And it was actually very eerie, because you'd go to this city, and it's this very collapsed economy. You have these skyscrapers, but then right within the shadow of the skyscrapers, you have thousands and thousands of abandoned houses. And people were taking over the lots, and they were converting these lots into gardens, and they were growing produce. And they were eating what they grew, and they were also selling it to local restaurants. So they were stimulating the local economy. I went to Boston, and I met people who were working with this group, partly composed of a credit union, partly composed of local activists, and partly composed of young students at the Harvard Law School. And they were working on a series of strategies to keep people who'd lost their homes due to foreclosure, to keep them in those homes and away from homelessness. And so all the way around the country as I went, I was finding these creative responses to conditions of poverty or conditions of insecurity. And that to me was immensely rewarding to look at, because it really does make you realize that people are very, very creative, and that people have all kinds of moral and emotional resources when it comes to trying to reimagine their conditions.
That is Sasha.
And, you know,
go ahead, Mia.
What we've seen really echoes what Sasha was just pointing out. I mean, the example he gave of the folks in Detroit who are, you know, they're dealing with their own food insecurity issue, right? They've come up with solutions themselves, and they're leveraging what they're doing to actually make money off of it by selling it to restaurants. And we see that all the time, and we as a nation, I think the invisibility that Sasha spoke about is something we also see. We as a nation don't see that. We don't see the amazing, creative, you know, talented things that people are doing in order to, you know, figure it out. And if we actually invested in that, you know, if those folks who are growing food in Detroit could actually apply for some kind of like match to savings or some kind of loan to leverage what they're doing and make that, like, you know, a more profitable business for them to be selling, you know, their food to restaurants, then we would just be investing in the solution that they've already come up with. And that's a big piece of what we're advocating for. And I think the piece that Sasha also spoke to, which is about the social connections that people lose when they're in poverty, is also something that we've seen and we've figured out how it is that people can actually rebuild those things. Because we know, despite the persistent myth of the self-made man, that nobody makes it alone in this country. Anywhere, you have to have other people supporting you, and both whether that's, you know, people, you know, paying for your education, or just like the psychological support you get from peers who you can, you know, vent to or get ideas from. Like, that piece is really critical, and we can encourage that. We can encourage people to stay connected to each other and maintain those relationships.
That is Mia Birdsong, Vice President of the Family Independence Initiative, an organization that envisions a future in which each person and family recognizes their self-determination. Sasha Abramski is a longtime writer on the subject of poverty and author of The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Live. It's the result of hundreds of interviews across the country with organizations that serve low-wage workers and the poor. He also interviewed a number of people. You can find interviews at voicesofpoverty.org. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you can relate to what we're talking about, we'd love to hear your personal experience. What changes would you like to see? And the president is going to talk about these issues tonight because really no one in Washington can ignore these issues any longer. But the question is, will we see actual policy changes? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Cynthia in Palo Alto. Hi, Cynthia. Welcome to the show. Hi, Cynthia. Cynthia wanted to say that companies have built high turnover into their business plans. Sasha, do you want to briefly touch on this? I mean, there a lot of companies are rewarded when they lay people off.
Well, I think one of the things we see is that in the low-wage economy, the model that's been built up is it's cheaper to develop disposable workers. It's cheaper because you don't have to provide health care benefits, you don't have to sign them onto long-term pension plans, you don't have to give them any of the benefits that come with seniority. And the other thing you don't have to do is you don't have to raise their pay, because most industries, there's an assumption that if you stay for a while, every year you're going to get a small pay raise. Well, if you build a business model that relies on cheap, high turnover labor, you don't have to do that. You pay somebody $7, $8 an hour. If they don't like it, they move on.
Right.
And you hire somebody else for $7, $8 an hour. And I think that this model of disposability, which is now being built into our reimagined service sector economy, ultimately is very destructive, because ultimately what it means is tens of millions of American families are trying to survive on casualized income. They're trying to survive on an income that isn't going to grow over the years, that doesn't come with pensions, that doesn't come with health benefits. And that's a recipe for chronic insecurity and all of the woes that go with that, from hunger to homelessness to lack of access to doctors and so on. And it really is something that we have to, as a society, grapple with, or it's going to completely change what kind of a country we live in 5, 10, 15 years from now.
Well, and that's also happening with jobs that pay in the 40s and 50s, because I know people who were let go and then people were rehired at the same salary but no benefits. So given this new reality, how do we deal with this?
Well, I think coming back to what I was saying earlier, there's nothing in the innate laws of economics that says that service sector jobs pay badly and old-style blue-collar jobs pay well. That's just a product of the fact that over many, many decades, workers in the blue-collar industries organized and pushed very effectively for higher wages. And I do think that over time, the same thing's going to happen now. You see it with domestic workers here. You see it with fast food workers. You see it with hospital assistants. You see it in Walmarts. All of these new low-wage sectors, people are starting to organize around living wage issues. But this other thing about good-paying jobs, people losing the jobs, and then younger workers being hired at a fraction of the price, you know, this is one of the great stories, or great is the wrong word, it's one of the terrifying stories of the last 6 years, which is that millions of people lost their jobs in 08, 09, and when those jobs returned, when unemployment started to dip and people finally found work again, yes, they're no longer unemployed, but they're earning a half or a third of what they used to earn. And their economic expectations have had to take an enormous hit. And I think that's a huge part of the story, that millions of middle-aged Americans who are preparing for retirement, suddenly they're earning a fraction of what they used to earn, and they're going to be working forever. They're not going to be able to afford to retire.
Well, you know, when you take a step back and really look at what we're facing, how do you explain why this is happening? I mean, because, you know, in the 70s and the 80s, there was always the sense that the company and the community really cared about the community and wanted the workers to be able to live a decent life, right? To send their kid to school, to have a decent home, to make ends meet. I mean, even, you know, members of my family who had went to trade school were able to make really good wages and live a decent life. Why do you think that how have we gotten to this place? I mean, we just hit the point where 100 CEOs now make over $100 million a year for the first time ever. I mean, we can go on with all of these studies, but what explains this, Sasha?
Well, I think one of the things that's happened is there's been a collapse in empathy. And empathy is the ability not just to sympathize with somebody else, but to really understand the world through their eyes, to understand what it means to go through the world in that person's head with those person's experiences. And from the 70s onwards, there's been this extraordinary increase in inequality. And one of the things that means is the common overlap, the overlap in experience between people at the top of a company and a workforce at the bottom of that company, that common shared experience isn't there. In the 1930s to the 70s, this period that economists tend to call the Great Compression, when inequality actually collapses in America to historically low levels, you see that there's an overlap in experience between people at the top of the economy and people at the bottom. There's shared experiences. But increasingly in the last 30 years, that's just not the case. So the richer you are, the more likely you are to live in a gated community, the more likely you are to send your children to private schools and private universities, the more likely you are to opt out of anything public. So if you need your garbage collected, well, there are association utility companies that come in and do the work. But the poorer you are, the more you rely on public structures. And those public structures are increasingly dilapidated because the tax base is disintegrated. And the reason the tax base is disintegrated is richer people increasingly have lobbied for declines in taxes at the top. And so I think we're in this sort of vicious circle that as people at the top get richer, so they use that power more effectively to divert resources upwards. And as those resources are diverted upwards, so people at the bottom become seen as more disposable. And as they become seen as more disposable, their life prospects deteriorate. So their housing becomes less secure, their access to education becomes less secure, their access to retirement becomes less secure. And it's this vicious cycle. And the challenge now is, how do we break out of that after 40 years where this rhetoric of government is bad, taxes are bad, has led to inequality and has led to disposability? How do we reshape this? How do we recalibrate again?
Is that how you see it, Mia? And how do we get out of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think Sasha has painted the picture beautifully, terrifyingly beautifully. You know, there's a deep lack of understanding of the things that are actually common between us. I think people who are wealthy don't see themselves as having a whole lot in common with folks who are low income, when in fact the only difference between them is that one has money and one doesn't. And I think the picture that Sasha painted makes sense to me. You know, I mean, I think that there's a piece that's really about, for us, is really about looking, that low-income communities really need to look to themselves and kind of the power of the collective. You know, unions are a fantastic example of what happens when you self-organize. And I think for us, there's this big piece that's about what is it that people can do together? What kind of power can they leverage when they're working together? What kinds of solutions can they help each other come up with? And it's not that means that it's about, you know, communities pulling themselves up by the bootstraps, because it's not that at all. But in order to know what it is that communities want and need and actually to pay attention, they need to have a voice, and they're not going to do that as individuals. They really need to do that together.
Well, we have a caller on this issue, so let's hear from Kevin in San Mateo. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, yeah. It just seems to me that, I mean, Sasha referred to how, you know, the unions had to fight low wages in manufacturing, and it's a recurring problem, and that it's not, as long as we have an economy that's undemocratic, we're going to have this problem. As long as we have the golden rule and we have economies that are mostly run by the few for the purpose of the few, I think we'll keep running into this over and over again, as well as the economy goes up and down. And that maybe the real solution in the long run is having an economy that is truly democratic from top to bottom. And I think that's the only way we'll get a political democracy as well, is if we have economic democracy, get back to the old ideas of socialism. I mean, certainly it involves rebuilding the unions throughout the economy and people, labor strength, but, you know, let's solve the problem once and for all.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Kevin. Sasha, final thoughts from you. We have about a minute left. It seems like now is a time to really make these changes, because there's all these studies. People are on the streets. This is an issue that's really being discussed right now. So where do you see this going?
Well, I think that for 6 years now, there's been a sort of opportunity to have this conversation. And for various reasons, we haven't had it. And now everybody's talking about it. Across the political spectrum, poverty is an issue that people are talking about. Inequality is an issue people are talking about it. Now, where do we go from there? One way says, well, we have a series of nice speeches, and then we go back to business as usual, and those 50 million Americans who are poor are left invisible. But the other scenario is that this really is now an issue with such momentum, and people see the moral urgency of it, that we're now going to see a series of really interesting initiatives. I think the first one will be around the minimum wage. I suspect there'll be an awful lot of attention tonight in the State of the Union paid to the minimum wage and the idea of a living wage. I think there'll be a conversation about dignity in the workplace. I suspect there's going to be some talk about how to make education more affordable, how to make microcredit systems more available in low-income communities. There are all kinds of ways that we can start re-empowering unempowered communities and re-empowering workers who have lost a tremendous amount of power over the last few decades. None of it's going to happen if it just is the theme of the day and then we move on to other issues. So this involves an ongoing community conversation. But I do think that there's a real chance, a once-in-a-generation chance, to have that conversation at the moment, and I really hope that we find a way to do so.
Sasha Abramski is the author of The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Live, and Mia Birdsong is vice president of the Family Independence Initiative, and you can find more information about their work at yourcallradio.org. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. How should the internet be regulated? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the fight for net neutrality. A federal appeals court recently overturned the FCC's Open Internet Order, which is a set of rules that prohibits internet providers from giving preference to applications or specific content. Critics say overturning those rules could spell the end of open access for all. So whose responsibility is it to keep the internet open, and why does it matter? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.